Путин мой кумир.
Путин великий человек и сильный человек.
Я его люблю, я его уважаю.
Нам нужны деньги, а не в Путин.
Там террористы, там, а здесь сепаратисты, которые
где Шарли был, где Марли был, где там Оланда был.
Ходорковский жулик, он воровал, значит, деньги.
He's like a cartoon villain, except that he's real. He can be pretty funny, except when he's terrifying. He's a bit of a clown and more than a bit childish, but he's also one of the most powerful men in Russia. It's pretty much impossible to ignore Ramzan Kadyrov, and he knows it. And the rambunctious Chechen leader is getting more brazen by the day. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia's security services, author of the blog In Moscow Shadows, and author of the book Russia's Wars in Chechnya. Welcome, Mark.
Hey there, and thanks for the plug.
Oh, I'm always glad to plug. And also joining us from London is journalist Oliver Bulla, author of the book The Last Man in Russia and the Struggle to Save a Dying Nation, and the author of an in-depth profile of Kadyrov that was published recently in The Guardian. Welcome back, Oliver.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
Good to have you. It's funny. We were having a conversation in an editorial meeting here, and we were worried that we were doing too much Kadyrov. Because, I mean, really, the man's been all over my blog this week. He's been all over the website. But at the end of the day, I mean, I think this is pretty important. Oliver, as you point out in your profile in The Guardian, and as Joshua Yaffa pointed out in an excellent profile in The New Yorker this week, it's kind of like a microcosm of Russia, or as I said in my blog, he's like the regime's id. He represents its kind of its darkest impulses in a lot of ways. So I stand by my decision to give Kadyrov a lot of airtime. Kadyrov, of course, was added again this week. He posting a video on Instagram showing opposition figures Mikhail Kasyanov and Vladimir Karamurza in the crosshairs of a sniper's rifle. And this, of course, comes just weeks after he called Vladimir Putin's foes enemies of the people, suggested in an article in Izvestia that they be placed in a psychiatric hospital in Chechnya, where he promised to double their injections. To get our discussion rolling, I wanted to start with a very simple question. It's something I addressed in the blog this week. What is Kadyrov to this regime? Now, I came up with three alternatives. They're not necessarily exhaustive, nor are they mutually exclusive. Here goes. I mean, number one, he's Putin's Frankenstein monster, a loose cannon that Putin created and is now stuck with but can't control. Number two, he's an extortionist, the ultimate wheeler dealer who pretends to be a madman to squeeze as much as possible out of the Kremlin. Or three, he's Putin's willing executioner, a boogeyman Putin used to terrify his opponents and, if necessary, to be his plausible, deniable death squad. Oliver, unlike Mark and I, you've actually met the man. It must have been an interesting experience. What do you think he is?
Well, it is a fascinating conundrum. I think, you know, I don't know. I mean, people talk about the revival of Kremlinology. I think maybe a new word is needed, a Putinology or something. And Kadyrov is a key aspect of Putinology, of the sort of strange constellation of figures in the Russian sky who rule over everything, and precisely how they're related to each other. And he's often used as, I mean, there's been some lovely analysis recently of him taking the place of Medvedev in the tandem of, he's sort of, now Putin's the moderate one and he's the extreme one. And there's this sort of argument, which, I mean, I've used a lot, which is the idea that things that happen in Chechnya prepare the ground for things that are later going to happen in Russia. And as if he's a sort of almost some kind of postmodern figure, the kind of man who Peter Pomerantsev, you need Peter Pomerantsev to analyze. but what I find is absolutely baffling is, I mean, I met him for the first time in 2003. This was a man who was barely able to speak Russian. His Russian was certainly significantly worse than mine. And I was obviously a foreign journalist in Chechnya talking to him. He was a kind of slightly awkward outside this building. His dad had gone in to vote, and he was slightly awkward hanging out, not really sure what he should be doing, not really sure if he should be talking to me. He didn't really, you know, once he spoke, he wasn't quite sure how off message to go, and eventually just kind of said whatever came into his head, which was, you know, violently off message, and sort of talking about how what a great military strategist Basayev was, and Maskhadov, how Maskhadov should come and work for his dad. All these things that that no Russian official would ever say, and that he clearly had no idea what he was supposed to be saying. And yet somehow he has become this strange blank figure. I mean, it's interesting you called your blog the Tao of Ramzan or Tao of Kadyrov. You know, and Lao Tse-Tung had this idea of the uncarved block, this idea of something on which you could project any potentiality. And it's almost like Kadyrov has become this strange figure on which you can project any interpretation you want of Putin's regime, because he's so weird and there's so much material. He splurges out so many Instagram posts and says so much. You could find anything to justify almost any interpretation of what's going on. So this is a very long answer to your question. Basically, I don't know. It's very hard to say. The man I met in 2003 was a village boy, you know, an ordinary. In Chechnya, they always use the word patsan, obyczny patsan. Yeah, he was. There was nothing to him that was in any way out of the ordinary or anything special. And yet somehow he's become this sort of stellar figure in Russian politics who just burns brighter and brighter and brighter. I mean, of course, there is before I move on and let Mark say something slightly more informed, there is another Lao Tzu quote, the flame that burns twice as bright burns half as long, which may be telling in this context as well. Anyway.
Now, you had an interesting quote in your Guardian profile of Kadyrov that was published back in September that I cited in my blog, where you said, if you think a Kadyrov that's out of the Kremlin's control is terrifying, contemplate a Kadyrov that is actually in the Kremlin's control. And actually, I'm not quite sure which of those two things is more terrifying.
Well, I agree. I mean, there's a lot of Putinism which is like that. I think it's similar to the Litvinenko hearing, which is scarier, a president who sends nuclear assassins to kill people in London, or someone who can't control whether they go or don't go. I mean, it's both aspects are scary, which is scarier. I mean, that's kind of a matter of interpretation. I think the same goes for Kadyrov. I mean, you know, I mean, Umar Israilov, who's one of the person who is most plausibly, you know, linked to having been murdered on Kadyrov's direct orders, who was killed in Vienna. I mean, I knew the guy. He was an absolutely lovely bloke, really making a go of life in the West. It seems that Kadyrov just sent a death squad to come out and kill him. I find it very hard to believe that Putin would have sanctioned that.
Mm.
However, what the interventions in Russian politics, calling, you know, the enemies of the people and so on, it's very hard to believe that he would do that without some kind of guide from the Kremlin. So I think he maybe got sort of one foot in both camps. He's, you know, he's pursuing his own vendettas against the Yamadayev brothers or Umar Israilov or Natalia Stemirova or whoever, while at the same time, you know, operating as a sort of Putin sanctioned figure in another direction. It is a very complex picture.
Mark, your thoughts?
Yeah, well, let me just start with that point about the killings of Chechens outside Chechnya, because, again, I think it says something about, as Oliver has noted, this sort of quite dual-faceted or multifaceted role that Kadyrov plays. If one looks at those assassinations of various Chechens who have become inconvenient or just simply disliked by someone in Russia, it's clear that some of them have been carried out by Chechen death squads that presumably were sent by Kadyrov. Others were carried out by what appear to be Russian intelligence service assassins. And again, I mean, for me, this is interesting because then when people say, oh, well, you see, Chechens are being killed abroad, who's behind it? Well, the answer is almost there are two parallel ones. One is actually statecraft thinking, this person in Ankara is a significant fundraiser. There are all kinds of good operational reasons why we need to get this person out of the picture. And because we are who we are, we're happy to use murder as the method. And then there are others who, from precisely just, you know, Kadyrov or someone close to Kadyrov just simply said, I don't like this person, kill him for me. And likewise, then, I think one of the issues is precisely unpicking which of his actions we might think of as in line with statecraft within Russia and which is just Kadyrov being Kadyrov. And in some ways, I think particularly what for me is concerning is the extent to which, shall I say, those two Venn diagrams are actually drifting apart. The Kadyrov and the Kremlin, their interests seem in some ways, I would say, less overlapping.
Mm, interesting.
But also the extent to which actually, again, because as we all know, a visual metaphor works really well on a podcast. the circle that is Kadyrov's own interests is getting bigger and bigger. And the one that is actually the Kremlin's sort of role here is getting smaller and smaller. So, I mean, I think, you know, to go back to your original question, those sort of three particular functions, you know, monster, extortionist, or executioner. I mean, in my view, he is, in different ways, a bit of all of them.
This is what I concluded.
Primarily,
in the blog, yeah.
I think he's in the first two. I mean, I think he was a monster who was created for a purpose. But the point is, having performed that purpose, in other words, subdued Chechnya, they're then stuck with what was created, and they don't really know what to do with him. And in part, his very strength is that he is this, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say stupid. I mean, clearly he has certain wiles, but in some ways he is politically clueless. He has none of the internal constraints that someone who is more subtle, more well-versed in all the intricacies of Russian politics might do. He just does what he does. And maybe someday he will cross a line. I can hope.
You've got to wonder where the hell that line's going to be.
Well, I think it's precisely because actually, just as we have found, I mean, again, I've made this point in the past, that sort of just as in a way Putin's great strength with dealing with the West is he just more or less says, look, I'm the one who's happy to step across the line. Do you really want to come over here with me? And the West, which is much more mannered and much more aware of risks and everything else, kind of backs away and thinks, oh, my gosh, no. Well, likewise, I mean, in some ways, that is what Kadyrov does, whether it's out of cunning strategy or just because he's not aware of the lines. He wanders blithely across them. Mm. And other people in the Kremlin are thinking, oh, gosh, are we really at the point at the moment of taking him on? Because I think there is this sense, I'm not sure how accurate I believe it is, but nonetheless, I think this is a genuinely felt sense that in a way you take Kadyrov out and the whole structure of Chechnya collapses. So that is basically Kadyrov's greatest strength in a way, whether he's aware of it or not. It's that sense of basically you let me do my thing or you might end up with Chechen War III.
I want to pick up on this divergence, Mark, because I think that's interesting, because you said he was a monster created for a purpose, and that was basically keep Chechnya, you know, loyal and passive, and kill as many people as you please, and we'll give you as much money as you need. Again, Oliver, as you pointed out in your profile, where this divergence seems to be taking place is now that Kadyrov is taking his methods to Moscow. He's taking them outside of Chechnya. He seems to have some kind of national political ambitions. And am I correct in assuming that's where you see the divergence happening?
I'm not sure I'd agree with that, but I saw that Oliver had something he wanted to say. So before we lose that, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, jump in, Oliver.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that he was created for a reason, I think, is a little bit misleading. He wasn't. His father was. His father was a totally different person. He was very thoughtful, had made an extremely difficult decision in extremely difficult circumstances. I think genuinely, whether you agree with his decision or not, for honourable reasons. There are very few people, even among his enemies, who would deny that. Ramzan isn't like that at all. His father was killed. Ramzan got the job by default, stepped in, and then when he got the job, he managed to squeeze out various rivals, first Alo Alkhanov and then, of course, the Yamadayev brothers.
Who were the favorites of the FSB.
And not just the Yamadayev brothers, but apparently the entire FSB apparatus in Chechnya he managed to wipe out, essentially. So he operated with, you know, low cunning and extreme brutality once he had the job. But he wasn't, I think the idea that Putin sort of selected this young man and gave him the job is a bit misleading. He didn't. He selected his father, and then Ramzan just sort of stepped into those shoes. And so, you know, we're sort of not, the place where we are isn't somewhere that I don't think anyone intended Chechnya to be where it is now, with the idea of this sort of, I think in my profile, I called him a cross between Uday Hussein and P. Diddy figure in charge of the country. Biggie Smalls, actually, not P. Diddy, which a lot of people pointed out was unfair to Biggie, which may well have been. I mean, that is not something I don't think that Putin intended to happen. So we're in uncharted territory that I don't think anyone is at the controls here.
Mm. Mark?
Yeah, I mean, I think this, obviously there was a sense, because there was also sort of a period where the seat was kept warm as president of Chechnya after his father had died and before Kadyrov was old, or Ramzan was old enough to be able to take over. But yeah, I mean, basically speaking, Kadyrov, insofar as there was an instrumentality about it, he was a war fighting tool. rather than anything else. I mean, I don't think anyone really sort of honestly sat there and thought, what do we think this guy is going to be like 10 years hence, let alone 20 years hence? It was a messy, scrappy conflict. There were a variety of different interest groups pushing different sort of local agencies. I'm sure they had a much more optimistic view of how effective they would be in controlling Ramzan Kadyrov, precisely because, you know, anyway, when they made that original decision, the Yamadayevs and so forth were around. There were the alternative militias, there were the alternative power structures. It's just that when he started killing these people, including ones in Moscow, that's when it sort of became a bit more tricky. Ooh, what do we do now? Again, are we really willing to fight a war to prevent this? And by drift, Ramzan ended up where he is now.
Let's talk a little bit about Kadyrov and Putin, because this is, again, is the, you know, Oliver, you pointed, as Sam Green wrote on his blog, they're the new tandem in a lot of ways, in the opposite direction of the Putin Medvedev tandem. Putin has said that Kadyrov's like a son to him. Kadyrov said Putin's his idol. Mark, you memorably said on the podcast a couple of weeks that Putin may have a man crush on Kadyrov.
Yes, I was so pleased that you actually made a point of putting that on your blog so it goes around as far as possible.
Come on, you're so damn quotable. How could I resist? I mean, it made the point I wanted to make, because I was writing that and I was thinking, Mark said something useful here, and I went back and listened, and I hope I didn't embarrass you. I thought it was a brilliant point.
No, next time I'm applying for a visa. the greatest hits. Okay.
But what do you, how do you see, Mark, this relationship? I mean, it's something that's central to Russian politics right now in a lot of ways. And
I'm not sure. I don't think I want to overplay it. I mean, it's central to, obviously, our coverage at the moment, because, you know, Kadyrov is making news. But, you know, this is not, shall
we
say,
the new tandem?
A real, no, I don't think that for a moment. If nothing else, you know, Putin does not need a demon at his side. I mean, he has ample ones of those. And in a way, I think Putin's strength has always been not that he wants to present himself as the gentle, moderate one, keeping the devil sort of under control, and, you know, better me than them. Part of Putin's strength has always been the fact that he unites within himself the sentimental, let me go and play with puppies, with the ruthless sort of figure. I think the idea of, I mean, the tandem was always to play to things that Putin couldn't do. And, you know, I don't think this
Kadyrov does things that Putin can't do.
Make himself into a warmer, cuddlier Putin who needs a Kadyrov. And but the point is about Kadyrov is exactly because he seems out of control. Look, either this is some kind of grand misdirection, in which case, why? I mean, it's not as though the West is now thinking, oh, we need to be sorry for that poor Mr. Putin because he has to deal with Kadyrov and he's having trouble reining him in. At the moment, either we think of Putin as just simply an unpleasant individual who is unleashing Kadyrov, or a weak individual who cannot control Kadyrov. Neither of those, I think, work particularly
with the West. But what about domestically? Because one of the things, and again, I raised this in the blog, he's this very convenient boogeyman for the opposition. And if somebody gets off, like a Nemtsov, Putin has plausible deniability. Kadyrov's nuts. I can't do anything about it. Yeah.
Is it? Yeah, but I mean, it's plausible deniability in the sense of saying, you can't blame me for this because I am weak and incompetent and cannot control one governor of one province. I mean, first of all, I don't think that actually gives Putin any strength at all. Secondly, look, there is no opposition, certainly no opposition that is actually worth seeming to question your very capacity to control, you know, agents.
That may be true, but the Kremlin fears one, and fears that one may materialize, especially as the economy gets worse. And there was one, so I mean, I wouldn't completely dismiss that they want to handle the opposition in one way or the other. And Kadyrov is a convenient way to do it.
But it's not. I mean, the point is, at the moment, fine, maybe at some point. But even so, I mean, I don't think that they think that the real opposition they're going to have to worry about will be about a handful of elite individuals of the sort of Nemtsovs and Navalny's and so forth of this world. It's going to be actually the Narod, getting fed up, and it's going to be something coming from the grassroots, and that doesn't, is that, you know, that's not something that, that Kadyrov can help you with. But secondly, look, I mean, I think that of all the various issues at the moment, I don't think that opposition politics is one that's really concerning anyone. I don't see any other signs of that. And secondly, look, I mean, it's interesting because there's been, you know, a recent opinion poll showing that the proportion of Russians with a positive opinion of Kadyrov has actually halved in the past year, down to 17%. Still 17% too many. But still,
I'd like, I mean, to see polls of how many people are terrified of Kadyrov.
But the point is, I mean, but, you know, if you're just some, you know, potential union agitator, if there are working trade unions, you know, out in Pskov or whatever, you don't think Kadyrov's going to come after you. I don't think that even factors.
But I'll tell you something interesting anecdotal, Mark. We went out and did some vox pops in the streets of Moscow and asked people their opinion of things Kadyrov was doing, and most people didn't want to answer. And they said things like, listen, I want to sleep better. I'd sleep better if I didn't answer your question. People were literally and visibly afraid to answer. And that's pretty telling.
Well, it's telling about something when a Westerner comes and puts a TV camera in
front of
you.
It wasn't a Westerner, it was a Russian.
Yeah. Well, but, I mean, presumably, it you know, you're open about who you were.
Of course.
And you're in Moscow, which, again, is always a sort of different thing. But when it comes down to it, I mean, look, I don't think without Kadyrov, I don't think if you took Kadyrov away, I don't think Russians would be thinking that the Kremlin was without instruments and without power. Mm. I think it does not fit, in my opinion, a niche, a need that is there, and certainly not proportionate to the costs. I mean, even the Russians themselves. I mean, exactly. Every time Kadyrov puts himself up on the news with this kind of thing, the security apparatuses don't like it. Even the kind of elite supporters of the government find it embarrassing. You know. You end up with Peskov having to make a, frankly, rather kind of pathetic equivocation to try and get out. No, he was only threatening a different type of oppositionist.
And that's a pretty low bar.
with murder. Exactly. No one, I mean, again, point to one person who seems to evince pleasure at this or any degree of satisfaction. I can't find
Putin.
Them.
Possibly, but let me pick up on that a little bit, because I want to kind of cite two anecdotes that I cited these two in the blog, and I'll go to Oliver to jump in on this. But after the Nemtsov assassination, according to Joshua Yaffa's profile in the New Yorker, Putin was reportedly refusing to take Kadyrov's calls, and Kadyrov was panicking. Now, apparently, at the end of the day, this was that weird time when Putin disappeared from public and everybody was wondering what the hell was going on. They apparently made up, because afterwards, Kadyrov got more medals from the Kremlin than he can fit on one chest. That's one anecdote. Another anecdote goes back to 2014 when Kadyrov was blowing up the families of suspected militants in Chechnya. Putin, at his call-in show, in response to a question from Ksenia Sobchak, I might add, said something along the lines of everybody has to obey the laws of the Russian Federation, and that includes the president of Chechnya. Extrajudicial violence is unacceptable. It's funny, pretty disingenuous, but that was supposed to be a clear message. Well, what did Kadyrov do in the coming days right after that? He blew up more houses. He didn't get reprimanded. Oliver, I mean, what is this relationship, and why can't Kadyrov get away with this?
If I remember rightly, what Putin followed that comment with, though I think in this case emotions are understandable. Mm-hmm. It wasn't as condemnatory as it might be if you sort of only quote a bit of it might look. I mean, I don't know. I'm very suspicious of anyone who claims to have an insight into the inner workings of Putin's relationship with anyone. I think this is one of those times when those who know don't talk and those who talk don't know, really. I mean, I think it's possible to find an analyst who will say whatever you want them to say, essentially.
Joshua was quoting about the phone calls, was quoting a journalist who's close to the Chechen elite. So, I mean, again, you're how many degrees of separation removed here? But
Well, I mean, this is it. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I certainly heard the opposite, and the medals, I think, would point in the direction of the fact that, you know, Putin wasn't that bothered.
Well, that's my larger point. Even though he wouldn't take his calls in the beginning, and when he gave him the medals at the end of the day, which was a very clear signal.
I mean, I do want to just come back to briefly just the opposite, the other side of what Mark was saying earlier, which is about how Kadyrov fits into the Kremlin elite, as it were. I think in Chechnya, all politics is local. Absolutely, Moscow is a source of money and nothing else. I mean, I think there's someone I spoke to for my profile, and I think Josh then went and found him and spoke to him as well, which is Magomed Khambiev, who was someone who changed sides in rather nasty circumstances in back in 2004. You know, he is, again, no one would, I don't think there is anyone who would traduce him and say he's anything but an honest and honorable man. You know, he has been left to live in peace by Kadyrov, and he does his best and gets on with things. He hasn't made money out of the elite. He lives still very modestly. He is the only person I saw in Chechnya in the elite who didn't have an iPhone. He just had an old Nokia. And he doesn't care about Putin. He's not interested in Putin. You say to him, you know, what do you think about Putin? He says, I don't think about Putin. I'm not interested in Moscow. I'm not interested in Russia. I'm Chechen. My government is Chechen. For me, you know, we are.
He was the most interesting character in your profile.
Absolutely. I mean, I have always been fascinated by Magomed Khambiev, partly because when he changed sides, his brother, who was health minister and was at that stage in exile in Italy, didn't change sides and remained loyal to Zakayev. But then later in life returned to Chechnya and they were reconciled slightly before Umar's death. It was a very Shakespearean story of tragedy, which was, and I think Magomed, he made a decision, which was that his family were going to be wiped out if he didn't change sides, and he took one for the team, expecting to be killed himself. He came and wasn't, and in fact was treated as almost a bit of a plaything by Kadyrov, a situation he dealt with great dignity. And he is, I think, very telling of essentially of an attitude of all the Chechens, of which there is still, I would say, a significant majority who would like to be independent. For them, they don't care what Putin wants, particularly, provided he's not killing them and he's still sending some money down the line. You know, what happens in Moscow is an irrelevance. It's like being concerned in Croatia with what's happening in Washington. I mean, you know, there is a significance there, but it's something that really only concerns you if you're at the very top of the government.
So you're saying that this is confined to Chechnya and doesn't have all Russian implications? Or?
Well, I think Kadyrov, essentially, he's playing to a domestic audience a lot of the time. He's a you know, an undereducated, semi-traumatized man who grew up in a war, lost his father at a young age, never had anything much to do with education. He's not particularly bright. You know, he's an internet troll. He likes messing around and posting. I mean, who doesn't? I mean, it's just he's got 1.5 million followers on Instagram and he
captive gets followers.
But he's got all these responses. I mean, you can imagine to a certain kind of mentality, you get this kind of, you know, the New York Times writes about how evil you are and you're like, lol, you know.
Who, beyond Putin and of course Surkov, Vladislav Surkov is also his ally. Who does he have any constituency in Moscow? I mean, I know the FSB can't stand him. We've talked about this in the past. Who are his patrons in Moscow other than Putin, or is that enough? Putin and Surkov.
Putin will do till he gets anyone else, right?
Right.
I mean,
but there's no other institutional, even within the Interior Ministry or anything else. He's pretty much, that's it.
Well, I mean, I think quite a lot of people tuck him behind Putin, right? I mean, I think the sort of Sergei Ivanovs of this world probably can't stand the guy. But, you know, he's a sort of walking middle finger pointed up at all of them. But, I mean, while Putin's got them, then I think everyone else will just have to tolerate him, really, won't they?
A couple other things I wanted to hit on before we moved on. One, I know what you think about this, Mark, this whole myth of the indispensable Kadyrov. The fear is very real in Moscow that if Kadyrov were removed, Chechnya would descend into chaos. But I know from conversations we've had over the years, you don't buy this, do you?
I don't think it needs to happen that way. I mean, obviously, there will be a whole question of how you manage any such process. But I mean, I think it really rests on two assumptions, both of which are questionable. One is, and again, it's Russians that are captives of 19th century literature, that sense of the Chechen as being this absolutely indomitable figure who is completely and utterly true to his word under all circumstances and will go down fighting rather than reach accommodation. Because there is this constant belief that the Kadyrovtsi, the local security forces who've sworn their personal oath to him, will, if need be, come and, you know, storm Moscow and such, which I, you know.
Not storm Moscow necessarily, but
Well, you do see that.
You do see that. Yeah,
that idiom being used. But at the very least, they're not willing to cut any kind of a deal at all. And secondly, the sort of the belief that somehow that Chechens are different and unique. And of course, they are on the same principle as everyone is different and unique. But they're also actually the same as everyone else. I mean, it is clear that there are going to be Chechens who absolutely could and would cut a deal if they felt that their either current interests would be protected or that they thought they would benefit from it. What you couldn't do, in my opinion, is get rid of Kadyrov and quickly reduce the amount of federal subsidy that you send to Chechnya. Because this is the devil's deal. If you go in there and just more or less saying, we're going to keep spending money on you, I'm sure you'll be able to buy enough people. As long as you also kind of want to say just stop all this silliness outside Chechnya, but just carry on doing your own thing. If you're still willing to accept that autonomy, a lot of Chechens will live with that. But on the other hand, if actually your real aim is to cut the amount of money you spend on it, then I think it would be very, very difficult to manage any kind of a transition. And again, in so many ways, I think you said is Kadyrov the sort of the id of Putinism. I think it's more that actually sort of that Chechnya is in so many ways...
The id of Russia.
Well, not even just the id, it's the karma. We have an Eastern philosophy sort of vibe going on today. It's actually so many bad decisions that are made, bad bargains, bad judgments, now all actually sort of coming together. And what you have in Chechnya is, in my respect, almost a caricature of Putin's Russia. The worst possible aspects without any of the redeeming elements, which, there are. And final point to make, I just wanted to pick up on something that Oliver said about, the sort of the regionalism. Again, in that respect, I think what Chechnya does is show us a process which is generally around. It's precisely Moscow is powerful and important, but it's not quite as central to most people's lives. Now, in Chechnya, again, as ever, that's taken to the nth degree. But I think generally we find it across Russia these days that actually the region, the city, is at least as, but generally much, much more important than what might be happening a long way away in Moscow.
But it is central to their lives because 80% of their budget comes from Moscow. And that is going to shrink. Oliver, you very eloquently spoke to this last time we talked about Kadyrov on the podcast a few weeks back. So Kadyrov is indispensable if the money is going to be cut. No?
I think this is the great unknowable, and it is a big problem. I mean, I remember very clearly, I don't think it'd be possible to forget what it was like in Moscow in the early 2000s, when you genuinely didn't know when the next suicide bombing was going to be.
Yeah.
They were, they just seemed to happen every week. I mean, it wasn't every week, obviously, but it's what it felt like. You never knew. And the metro stations, a rock concert just outside the Hotel National, outside cafes, on aeroplanes, it was just, you couldn't help yourself. You got onto a marshrutka and you'd look around just to check.
Yeah, no, Pushkin Square was the last story I covered in Russia before leaving. I remember that atmosphere.
Horrible thing. And that is no more. And that isn't a small thing to remember. That, I mean, how much is that worth in billions? It's difficult to put a price on it. But this is, in a way, what the Kadyrov system has achieved is stopping that kind of horror all the time afflicting Moscow. And so, I think that they would be loath to risk any kind of return to that instability. It was horrible. I don't think anyone would, anyone would be prepared to risk that.
So they're not going to cut the budget to Chechnya, would suggest.
If they do, I think they'll find ways of trying to compensate in other ways. I think they would be foolish to leave Ramzan without a penny to build himself a new palace.
Right. Last thing I wanted to hit on is the idea of Kadyrov after Putin, because they are so linked together in a lot of ways. And could Kadyrov survive after Putin? And I wanted to quote from Joshua Yaffa's profile in The New Yorker about this. I'm quoting Nikolai Petrov, an expert on Russian regional politics, about this, saying, and I'm quoting here, Kadyrov has the potential to be a czar maker, not because he has more men at his disposal than, for example, the Minister of Defense, but because his men, tens of thousands of them, will carry out his orders without thinking twice. If the Minister of Defense tells his troops to storm the Kremlin, he can't be sure that all of them will actually do it, but Kadyrov can. Now, Mark, I know you're smirking, and I know you're skeptical of this, because I just kind of quoted somebody saying you were something you were caricaturing a few minutes ago. But I think Petrov makes an interesting point here, that Kadyrov has made himself an indispensable part of the system, regardless of who's in the Kremlin or not. Mark, you're the skeptic,
first. In some ways, I mean, I think if we try to think of a post-Putin succession, I think it would be very hard to think of someone, I mean, unless it actually became their central shtick, their central basis for power, I can handle the Chechens. But broadly speaking, odds are whoever comes in would really just not want to touch the whole issue of Chechnya. Mm-hmm. So I can't think of them coming in with all the various changes and all the various sort of challenges that would involve, and at the same time then thinking, oh, and while I'm at it, why don't I unpick the current status quo in Chechnya? That would be fun, because I need something to do on my spare time out. You know, I mean, I think it almost certainly then basically someone would be just willing to just simply just let this essential independent statelet continue. But that's a very different matter from actually saying that Kadyrov will have a stake in who actually makes that decision. I mean, again, unless he's willing to really push it to the line and say, I will send my men to come and storm the Kremlin unless you pick the guy I want, which actually then is almost forcing the...
He wouldn't have to do that. A few bombs in Moscow would do it.
Well, yeah, but bear in mind that you might say the answer is, I mean, either those few bombs in Moscow are Kadyrov declaring war, which actually, again, might be exactly the kind of thing that someone needs to make, that the decision to who then replaces Putin becomes who we think can best destroy Kadyrov. And that's the kind of thing which actually would play to God help us all, someone like Ivanov. Mm-hmm. In other words, it makes it more likely that we would get a sort of a security type in position rather than a person who can kind of comfort the West. Or it suggests that Kadyrov isn't in charge of what's going on, in which case he becomes more dispensable. I just don't think he has much active traction. I think he can basically say, I don't care who you appoint in Moscow, as long as that person accepts that Chechnya is mine and it's on your credit card.
Right. And the second point is the really operative point there. Oliver, what are your thoughts?
I'm nervous of again. I think you can find an analyst to tell you whatever you want. I'm nervous of any analysis of Kadyrov that presents Putin as sort of Emperor Palpatine and Kadyrov as this sort of Darth Vader with these hordes of stormtroopers ready to pour, you know, repeatedly.
Star Wars comes back. Where's Kirill? Yeah, you know,
just the idea that they're just going to repeatedly throw themselves into the breach till there's none of them left. I think there's a lot of orientalizing that goes on about Chechnya. I don't think Chechen, you know, Kadyrovtsy or whatever units are any different to any other troops. I think they are as unlikely to want to throw themselves into an utterly pointless battle as anyone. Especially considering the fact that large numbers of these people have no particular affection for Putin in the first place. This isn't, you know, they fight for Kadyrov. They are paid handsomely to fight for Kadyrov. A lot of these people and their families previously fought for an entirely different system against the very people they're currently fighting for. This idea that these sort of hordes of people are ready to line up in lines like Uruk-hai, and sorry, just to change film and march on, you know, the White City and start, you know, hurling themselves into the breach. I just don't think it's true. I don't think, and also I don't think Putin is a czar maker. I mean, Kadyrov is a czar maker. I think if anything would be likely to unite the squabbling elites in Moscow, it's the idea that Kadyrov would have the casting vote. I think everyone else would immediately throw themselves together to try and come up with some other opportunity. I think he is, you know, the boss of Chechnya and all that. But as he has repeatedly been showing in the last couple of years, he's been trying to expand his authority outside Chechnya just to, you know, bits of the Stavropol region or just to Ingushetia or bits of Dagestan, and has been failing. Mm-hmm. The idea that he would be able to somehow step over the Stavropol region and all the bits in between to go to Moscow, I think, is a bit fanciful. It's a lovely idea, but you know, I'm afraid I'm yeah, I'm probably more of a Cadiro skeptic than a lot of people.
Can I actually just throw in one little PS? In today's Argomenti Facti and elsewhere, we've had the thing about Kadyrov sort of formally saying, of course, I have absolutely no aspirations to a merger between Chechnya and Ingushetia. That would be a foolish notion. Whereas clearly that was one of the very first bits of empire building he tried back in the day. But again, absolutely, if you can't even get Ingushetia, then I think actually the Garden Ring is going to be a bit insurmountable.
I don't want anyone to think we're dissing Ingushetia, by the way. It's a very nice place. But
we are definitely not dissing Ingushetia. On that note, we'll shift gears. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and take a look at the change at the top of Russia's military intelligence and what it pretends. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog Moscow Shadows and of the book Russia's Wars in Chechnya. And joining us via Skype from London is journalist Oliver Bulla, author of the book The Last Man in Russia and the Struggle to Save a Dying Nation, and a fascinating profile of Kadyrov in The Guardian that everybody should read. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Новым начальником главного управления генштаба
генерал-лейтенант Игорь Коробов.
Коробов уже представлен генералом и офицером военной разведки.
Полковник Игорь Сергун скончался 3 января 2016 года.
GRU, Russia's military intelligence, got a new leader this week. General Igor Korobov replaces Igor Sergun, who died of an apparent heart attack on January 3rd at the age of 58. Mark, on your blog, you wrote that this represents a continuity choice. What does that mean, and what can we expect going forward?
Well, it's continuity because, in a way, I think it shows that attempts to precisely break the continuity have failed, because we know that there was some kind of behind-the-scenes activity, some sort of politicking to get an alternative candidate, and that's Lieutenant General Dumin, who had sort of relatively recently, appropriately enough, parachuted into the military from the Presidential Security Service, the Presidential Bodyguard. And this is one reason why it took a month less one night to actually announce the succession, which again is unusually long, especially because, you know, I think we'd had three times before then sort of informal, oh, there's going to be an announcement tomorrow or any day now. So I think it says really three things. One is that Putin seems to have, and something I know you did on the Daily Vertical today, an increasing desire to basically have people whom he really knows and trusts, which increasingly basically means his bodyguards. Well, as he sequesters himself really more and more from the rest of Russia and even the rest of the Russian elite, these are the people he sees the most. So anyway, he's trying to seed them into sort of key locations, it seems. Secondly, though, the limitations of Putin's power. I mean, I think it's interesting that, you know, clearly he wanted this.
He wanted Dumin, you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's no one else who really could have been pushing it with any kind of heft. Obviously, I think, you know, if push had absolutely come to shove, of course, he could have appointed whoever he wanted. But nonetheless, I think whereas the military don't seem to have much active traction on policy, I think what this did show is they can actually unite and block and stonewall any such thing, and almost make it just a bit too politically expensive for Putin to go ahead. It's quite interesting, even just there was quite a few sort of news items and things which were clearly the military lobbying through the press as to why Dumin was not the right choice. So, I mean, I think, you know, they definitely did not want the idea of a drop-in. And, I mean, I don't know if it's true, but I just heard this as a rumour. Unusually enough, the suggestion is that the Federal Security Service, not usually the closest allies of the military, let alone the GRU, actually also supported, because I suppose they felt that the precedent is an unfortunate one. If you're going to get a presidential bodyguard in the head of one, being sort of appointed into key positions into one intelligence agency, why not into other ones?
And there's a trend going on there. I mean, you have Viktor Zolotov as deputy interior minister and in charge of the interior ministry troops, who's always this potential interior minister at any point. If Dumin had gotten this post, I mean, you see, is everybody uniting against the FSO? And if so, why?
I don't think it's a question of uniting against the FSO. I think it's more everyone tends to unite against outsiders being thrown into your key positions. One can also look at the fact that Dumin's on Putin's own personal little sort of hockey team.
Right.
Zolotov's a judo sparring partner. I mean, one could just as easily have said, what have anyone got against sportsmen around Putin? It's not. It's just basically no one likes having an outsider imposed into key positions.
So there isn't an institutional struggle going on between the GRU, the FSO, the FSB, and so on. That's not, and there's fears of kind of, because the bodyguards are spreading, and you've pointed out a lot of lesser known figures that were through mid levels of the bureaucracy. Incidentally, credit where credit is due, Mark. You really gave me the idea for today's Daily Vertical, so I have to thank you publicly since I didn't cite you on camera. But is there an institutional struggle going on at all?
I don't think so. It's always fun to find one. That always makes for a great story. And it's also one of these things that it's impossible actually ever to prove isn't going on. But I'm not getting a sense of anything more sort of tectonic. I think it is more than just, if Sergun hadn't died, this wouldn't have been an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Just that when it became an issue, and then all of a sudden, you have this chap, Dumin, who's already had a strangely meteoric career rise within the military. And frankly, one, if you don't mind, just a little sidebarring.
Yeah,
I'm going into my full spook wonk bit. But
that was my idea.
There's this new story about, Dumin, because he was in charge, apparently, of military special forces for a while, and that he was responsible, for the operations in Crimea and for spiriting Yanukovych. Yes. Out of Kiev. Well, the interesting thing is, in mid-2015, there's press reports that were still saying that Dumin was in the Presidential Security Service. Now, it could just simply be that they were wrong, that no one had kind of updated, but I haven't managed to find a single reference before that point in the press of Dumin being in the military.
So what does that mean if he was, in fact...
I think he may well have been responsible for the Yanukovych extraction, because that is actually the kind of thing which, presidential security, bodyguards and so forth, that fits in with their own...
Yanukovych was, after all, a president at the time.
Yeah,
still,
exactly. So I could well believe, but while he was still within the Presidential Security Service. Crimea, I don't think he would have had in any role.
So they were trying to build up a profile and an image of him, of course.
This is a kind of exactly a hurried... Mm-hmm. retrofit. Otherwise, it was basically, it seems to have been within 6 months, he went from colonel in charge of presidential bodyguard detail to head of army special forces to chief of staff of the ground forces. And chief of staff, that's a really important job.
Yeah.
The job of the chief of staff is the guy who gets to pick up the pieces that everyone else has dropped. In other words, it's someone who really should know what they're doing. It would have helped, for example, if it had been a career soldier. And then all of a sudden to deputy defense minister, wonderfully without portfolio. And in that process, in 6 months, he seems to have gone from colonel to one-star lieutenant general to two-star major general.
Right.
I'm sorry.
It's quite a rise.
Again, I just think this is kind of an attempt to retrospectively burnish credentials.
Now, what did you make of that piece in Zgliad that came out yesterday? It was basically justifying the appointment of Khorobov, basically saying, this represents stability. The other candidates, they're good in their professions, but they're not, the leader of the GRU. What did you make of that? It was just post-factum PR justification?
Yeah, I mean, I suspect it's just the kind of sort of shoddy stuff that I could have written, of just because, again, you can throw bits and pieces together. I mean, it's perfectly true what they were saying about certain of the candidates. One of them was very much a sort of a missile specialist, Khrushchev.
Right.
Another one, I mean, his real claim to fame had been, or infamy, had been his role as clearly sort of senior military spook in Estonia. But the interesting thing about Khorobov is, I mean, two things. One is that no one seems to really know anything at all about him. The best anyone could say, he's a serious man, seriozny chelovek. Well, I mean, I must say, if that was going to be the epitaph on my gravestone, I would feel faintly peeved if that's the best I could come up with. But the second thing is, I mean, he was head of the Directorate for Strategic Intelligence. In other words, as it were, big picture stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He almost certainly actually, therefore, would have played quite a considerable role in Syria. And other kind of, again, big picture issues. So very much to me, what this says is that, he knows the ropes. He presumably is up to the job. I mean, Sergun was effective, but was apparently having to sort of work very hard to keep on top of all his various responsibilities. But certainly I don't think it means that we're going to see the GRU doing anything in particular different tomorrow. than it was yesterday.
Right. So it's, as you said, a continuity choice.
Friday the 5th of February is Karabov's first actual day in job.
Right. There's some interesting stuff around Dubin, too. I mean, he was appointed now acting governor of Tula, which was apparently a consolation prize. But there's been speculation in the press I saw today that he, as a potential successor to Putin, I was like, what? Where the hell did, I don't know if you came across that. Durenko was pushing
this. I suppose you might say, given his meteoric military career, he clearly is a sort of Alexander the Great in waiting. Well, maybe they're expecting essentially sort of a similar meteoric political career, you know, today, right. Tula, whatever. I mean, look, I think that, again, everyone is scrambling to write. No one really knows anything. Just right. as no one really knows anything about Karabov, no one really knows anything about
Dubin. Yeah.
And therefore, people will just kind of come up with stuff to write.
Right. One last thing before we wrap it up for this week, I'd like to throw this to both of you, is like, Putin, as we noted, is seeding the bureaucracy and seeding, you know, different parts of the empire, if you will, with his bodyguards. What does that say about the security, the question I posed at the end of my daily vertical this morning, but what does that say about the confidence of a leader who feels the need to seed the bureaucracy with his bodyguards?
I think all empires, all non-democratic empires come to this stage. The Roman Empire did it. I think it gets to the point when, you know, who do you hang out with? I mean, who do you end up trusting but the people who guard you? I think it's, you know, you progressively isolate yourself from these people. I mean, it's fascinating news about, you know, Yakunin is, you know, has got this, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. And Vladimir Yakunin seems to be, you know, being carved up as we speak with sort of an egg here and an arm there. And, you know, it seems, I think as the circle around him gets smaller and smaller, the only new blood who might conceivably enter into it are the people who stand around, you know, holding guns and making sure no one else comes in. So it all seems very sort of, you know, latter days of Rome to me, but then, you know.
So the regimes come to that, are you saying? Well, I mean, because that suggests something.
I'm always someone to look for, you know, offbeat literary references. So it all looks a bit I Claudius to me, but you know, again, next week I'll think it's something else. I mean, that's just how my mind works.
Mark, last word to you before we call it a week.
I think Oliver's absolutely spot on. This is what happens to empires when the sort of the circles close. I think we should just simply be relieved that there isn't, I don't know, Putin's horse hasn't been put in charge.
That's next week.
Okay. On that note, we will Putin's horse. On that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow has been Mark Galeotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia's security services, author of the blog In Moscow Shadows, and author of the book Russia's Wars in Chechnya. And joining us from London has been journalist Oliver Bulla, author of the book The Last Man in Russia and the Struggle to Save a Dying Nation, and of a fascinating profile of Ramzan Kadyrov in The Guardian. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening and lively discussion.
That's been fun.
It was very fun. I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFURL's Russian language television program, Current Time, whom you can follow on the Twitter at Pasha Butorin. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFURL.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.